Okay. I'll tell you, we're going to do two things this morning. The last thing we're going to do from 10:30 or so, 10:45 to 11:15, Daphne Durbin from the American Center for Wine, Food, and the Arts is going to talk about the oral histories that we did last year during the symposium in concert with the American Center for Wine, Food, and the Arts, and show you some clips from that that are wonderful. But before that, I have the pleasure of introducing y'all to our incoming Southern Foodways Alliance Board President, Tony Tipton Martin. Tony has been a great part of this organization, and Tony was the first African-American food editor at a major metropolitan daily newspaper, Cleveland Plain Dealer. Her colleague, John Long, is somewhere out there. Formerly a member of the food staff at the Los Angeles Times, she now lives in Austin. It's my pleasure to welcome her here. Tony, we talked about having, we've been talking all weekend about what happens when Southerners leave the South. And Tony's going to talk about Los Angeles and its inherent Southernness from her perspective. Tony Tipton Martin, thank you.
Well, first I want to say that it is, I don't want to bump any of the lights today. It's an honor for me to be here and a privilege because this is really the culmination of a career that has been at once both frustrating, emotional, and exciting for me. Though I was not born and raised in the South, I have always felt an emotional connection to it. I've had to avoid certain people this morning because I'm already about to burst because I'm very, very privileged to be in this capacity, and I hope that I won't disappoint. I thought when I accepted the nomination that this was going to be kind of an easy thing to do. You just have to be orderly and mechanical and very much like an editor and organized. And then all I would have to do really is pursue the course that John T. had already set for the organization. And then he asked me to speak at the last minute. And as the journalists in the room know, no journalist wants to be unprepared. We do volumes of research before writing and wouldn't dream of trying to be the expert on a topic as grand as this without having a lot of preparation. So you can already tell that speaking to a group of experts who are talking about their home and their love, this was very challenging for me to have to encounter after a very deep glass last night. So I decided that I would approach this the way that I approach a 5K race, which is I'm just as nervous. I'm always as clumsy in the beginning of my run. And then somewhere around the second mile, I kind of cool out and get into my rhythm, and my stride is okay, and I'm not breathing so hard. And by the end, I cross the finish line, and I look back, and it really wasn't all that bad anyway. So that's kind of the approach that I'm taking. And as I said, I had quite a bit of anxiety. And then wonderful Jessica Harris stood in line in front of me at the bookstore at the book signing. And to my surprise, she had two copies of my children's, well, my favorite children's story. It's called Stella Luna. And for those of you that aren't familiar with Stella Luna, Stella Luna is a little bat that, oh, she has it! Where did you get that? We're going to have to leave early. Stella Luna. Oh, can I hold it while I talk? Stella, does anybody know more about Stella Luna than just Jessica and I? Okay, so Stella Luna is this sweet little bat, and she loses her way. She gets lost from the nest, from her family, and she finds herself in a bird's nest. And she tries as mightily as she can to become like the birds, and she eats bugs, even though she says they taste really icky. And she tries to fly during the day, and she tries to accommodate the birds in every way that she can, and she's failing miserably. So the mother bird explains to Stella Luna that she's really becoming a nuisance to the family, and she's teaching the baby bird some pretty bad habits. And Stella's afraid she's going to get thrown out of the nest. So, of course, she tries to accommodate the mother bird, and she promises, I will eat bugs without making faces, and I'll do all I can. I'll fly, you know, I won't hang upside down anymore, and I'll fly during the day. And she's flying around, and I can't remember the whole thing, but she meets her bird family, as fate would have it. And they all think she's kind of weird, but they teach her that bats are really okay, and that they eat some pretty delicious food, too. And she can't wait to get back to the nest and share that with the birds. And so, of course, now the birds want to go and be like the bats. And everybody knows birds can't be like bats. They can't cook like bats, certainly. So the bats and the birds, after wondering how can they feel so much alike and yet be so different, and conversely, how can they be so different and feel so much alike, they decide to forget about it and be friends anyway. And the closing picture in this book is Stella Luna hanging upside down. I think she's sleeping. They're sleeping. She's upside down on the branch above the birdies, and the birdies are on the branch below, and they're sleeping, and she's embracing them, and they decide to just get along. And I just really love that story because it really sort of depicts my life, and in a way I feel like I'm Stella Luna. I grew up in the promised land of Los Angeles, and to Southerners, I think that's really what it meant. They thought that they were going to a place where they would not be demoralized and mistreated anymore. I grew up in a neighborhood that was characterized by the LA Times as one of the most prized pieces of real estate in the city because of its unusually unique panoramic views of the mountains, the ocean, and the downtown skyline. I grew up in an environment that really didn't have a black community in the sense that it is portrayed in the media, the popular culture. And I don't think I have to explain what that means. And I think that there's a couple of reasons for that. Our parents were of a generation that had watched their fathers be demoralized and have their lives threatened on the streets of the South. In my case, my father had experienced incredible brutality against his father in Bonham, Texas. And so when they left the South, they wanted to leave all that behind. And unfortunately, I think, this is my opinion, but I think that South Central LA came to typify that for them. And so a lot of families made skid marks to leave what appeared to be a Southern kind of an enclave within, as I think Jessica said yesterday, you know, there's segregation among the races, and then there's segregation among the race. And there was this separation among our culture, and people fled from South Central Los Angeles. So I grew up in a neighborhood where Ike and Tina Turner's children used to ride their big black Great Dane Onyx down the street, and Ray Charles handed out cheeseburgers for Halloween. Barry Gordy's daughter, Hazel, used to drive by all of us standing on the bus stop waiting to go to our integrated school at the beach in her stretch limousine. So it was a very different upbringing, but at the same time, we ate neck bones and collard greens and sweet potatoes and black-eyed peas just like everybody else. We just, like everyone else in the room yesterday, didn't know that it had a character, that it had a name. It was, as Jessica so eloquently said, dinner. We knew about these places like Murray's Soul Kitchen and the famous Creole place Harold and Bell's, but we didn't go there. It was food that you could eat at home. And why on earth would anybody pay to buy food that somebody was already preparing for you at home? We also began to grow economically, and so we were exposed, like everyone, like most other urban blacks, we were exposed to other cuts of meat and better foods, and we moved along just like the rest of society, and we ate a lot of spaghetti. In fact, in soul food restaurants, you often find spaghetti on the plate with all the Southern food. We ate a lot of tacos. And as I said, we were bused to integrated schools near the ocean, and we basically learned, like Stella Luna, to fit in an environment that was not comfortable or familiar to us. After high school, and I'm going to try to be quick and brief. After high school, I worked for a black weekly newspaper in Los Angeles that was essentially a community newspaper of 13 communities, but it happened to reflect mostly black residents. And the most hysterical part of my career was when they named me food editor. And all my friends thought that was outrageous. I mean, they even wanted to write the newspaper to write the story they announced that I was going to be food editor. They thought that was just so wild. So I did the usual recipe stories, trying to figure out how to match. If there's an ingredient up here, they better mention it down here. I mean, you know, that's what food editing to me was at 20 years old. And I was in college at the time at USC. And so I did the usual, and I don't think it really was occurring to me on a conscious level, but I was starting to discover that there was a pattern, that as I was researching and writing and doing these stories, I wasn't really finding anything that stood out as black culture, but I didn't really notice that because of my upbringing. It really didn't, you know, matter anyway. And then I was fortunate enough to be hired by the LA Times, and I was probably the youngest person they ever hired. I was hired to be there part-time and just kind of do the grunt work in the back, but I had much grander ambitions than that. And so to kind of quiet me down, they said, well, why don't you write about, nutrition. Yeah, write about nutrition. And that was could have been a very confounding experience for me, but being my daughter's child, I went to UCLA at night. And I learned about nutrition, and I took physiology, and I cut up cats in my garage, and I did all kinds of things to make sure that I could do it. And as a result, I won a lot of nutrition writing awards, but I was bored stiff. And I wanted to write a story about the King holiday. I wanted to share. At the same time, I was working still for this Wave newspaper under my maiden name. And I wanted to share what I was learning in the big leagues with all these little people in the community. That was, I felt, my charge. And so I wanted to write this story about the King holiday and what you ought to serve. And I started researching. I could not find one topic on black food. I could find Southern food. I could find African food. But you know, there was a cookbook. Of course, there was the Darden book and Verda May's work, but I couldn't really find anything that was what I was beginning to know about cooking, which was these monolithic, you have Italian, you have French, you know, well, why didn't you have African-American? And so I pursued that, and I couldn't find anything, and I finally resorted to calling Merle Evers, and I interviewed her, and she gave me a menu and suggested this is what people would serve on the King holiday, and the Times backed out. They were afraid that it was too soon in the celebrating of the career to know, of the holiday to know whether people were going to celebrate it subtly or were they going to jump up and shout. So they wouldn't run it, and I had all this research, and I decided, well, maybe I'll put it into a cookbook. At about the same time, Ruth Reichel showed up and saved my life, really. And I have thanked her publicly and privately about it. She came on board and said, do you want to do this? And I said, no. And she said, well, then don't. Do whatever you want. And she wanted to write much of what you see in Gourmet. She wanted to tell these interesting pieces about interesting people. And, of course, she thought, I must know about the community, so why don't I write about some of those people? And, of course, I grew up in the West Side, and I didn't know anything about any of those people. And so I trotted off to Murray's on 51st and Main and had my first bite of chitlins. And we wrote a story about offal. And, you know, rolled the chitlins into this awful piece, and it turned out to be really interesting and good. And I felt like I participated, and that was sufficient. I didn't have to, you know, be beating the African-American drum over anybody's head. And then we decided to do comfort food. And the reflection of that turned out to be my grandmother's devil's food cake. And it turned out in my research of that, that she was the chef for the Wilshire E. Bell Theater in Los Angeles, and nobody ever even talked about it. And even more to my surprise, that she and her twin sister had a seafood restaurant in Oklahoma somewhere. I don't remember exactly where. And I was so surprised to find that this was happening among my friends, all of my family. People were not talking about what happened in their families before their generation. It was as if Los Angeles existed as an island and no one knew anything outside of that, certainly not about the South. And so we continued to write stories that would look at Southern African-American food beyond this obscured view at Aunt Kizzy's back porch, where, you know, where they're feeding mostly white people in Marina Del Rey. But the culminating moment was when I wrote a story about the cobbler lady. And this was your typical, the only thing she was really missing, and I probably can say it, no one else can, was the bandana on the head. I mean, she was straight out of the pages of the past. But she was making the absolutely most incredible cobblers anybody had ever tasted. And, of course, I, being a good journalist, had been quite invisible to this point. Nobody knew I was Black. So I write this grand story about this woman and this wonderful taste of these pies. And people came out of the woodwork. They were calling the Times. They wanted to know, where was it? Was it safe to go there? As we heard yesterday, it must be in the neighborhood because her picture ran in the paper. So it was clear they would have to have been in the neighborhood, and people were worried about that. And I began to find the voice that I was looking for, and I was so grateful to Ruth for giving it to me. And I was really ready to rock and roll, and then somebody called me from the plane dealer in Cleveland. And they wanted to know if I would consider coming back for an interview. And I said, well, let me get a map and find out where Cleveland is, and then I'll call you back. And once I discovered that there was a big body of water there, and it would remind me of the ocean in Los Angeles, and the small fact that I would be the first Black food editor in the country, I decided maybe I would take this job. I even got, just like at the beginning of my career, I received phone calls from white food editors around the country who said, we heard that you were going to take this job, and nobody can really believe you would leave the Los Angeles Times to go work for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. And I said, well, it's true, and it wasn't a lateral move for me because there was nobody doing it at the time. There was no one in management, and it would give me a unique opportunity to be visible and to hopefully accomplish what I had dreamed of doing my whole life, which was giving something back to this community that I was yearning to know more about, and nobody around me knew anything about it, so I thought. And so very quickly while I was at the LA, at the Plain Dealer, I did the usual mechanical editing stuff, and it was, you know, making me crazy, and John will tell you all about how crazy I was. I really hated the political corporate thing. I wanted to write about people. I wanted to do the kind of oral histories that I read were the way that African Americans shared their history and their futures with their children, and there really was no forum for me to do that. Publishers were not interested in it. And then Joe Randall came along, and we both shared a similar interest in that we both wanted to lure African Americans back into the kitchen. And we had already encountered not only this denial, but also the frustrations over the nutrition police and making African Americans and thus Southerners feel as though there was something wholly unhealthy about this cuisine. And I began a campaign of appearing in television and other things and saying, well, why don't you just eat fewer Big Macs? And then maybe you could have that pot of greens that has about an eighth of a teaspoon of grease in your serving. And, you know, it started to catch on. But then I encountered upscale African Americans who said, well, I just don't eat that anymore. Oh, and, you know, it wasn't pretty enough, or it wasn't something that they could serve to their guests. So when they had these fairs, they wanted to bring in caterers and demonstrate their success. And all the while I was traveling around and going back home and stepping off the plane, heading straight for Golden Bird Fried Chicken, or Woody's Barbecue, or the very weird fusion of the po' boy, which turned out to be the you buy, we fry concept in LA, where you could just go in and get your fish. And that, you know, that was really revealing to me that people just didn't want to have anything to do with the cooking. You know, that, okay, I could still have it as long as you fry it. And the barbecue joints had already been there, and Golden Bird had always been there, but those two in particular were offering something that other people weren't, in that there was a taste that was so much different. Golden Bird Chicken, which is an icon in Los Angeles, has a very unique crust. It's really crunchy, and you can't hardly eat it without the little bread and butter pickles that go on the side and come in a little carton on the side, and it's, you just have to have them together. And that was how Southern food morphed when it got to Los Angeles, and we just didn't even recognize it as Southern food. But at the same time, I was being very frustrated when I was traveling around as this food editor, going to places like Dallas for the Food Editors Conference or Atlanta, and having people ask me if I could get them a drink. At the same time, going out and sneaking in the back and asking the cab driver, where do the people go? You know, where can I get something to eat? I'm so sick of eating this food in Buckhead. Can I, you know, sorry, Susie. I just, you know, I couldn't eat another bite of quail. I wanted some catfish and grits and biscuits more than I could think about it. And so my husband and they wouldn't tell me, and I think it was because maybe they believed thought I really didn't want to know, or that I was with this group, so I couldn't possibly really be from the hood, or, you know, whatever all that baggage is. My husband got out of somebody that we should go to the beautiful restaurant of the perfect church. And we said, well, where is it? And they said, oh, it's quite a ways, but, you know, I'm telling you, it's the best food you'll eat. So $60 later, we get out of this cab, and we have a $9 breakfast, and then we go back to Buckhead. But we were very, very happy, and it just solidified for me that the Taste of Heritage Project was right, and then if we could get people attracted back to the food, they would want to cook it, they'd want to go back into the kitchen, they'd work, they'd become caterers, they'd be off welfare. We had this humongous idea that, you know, we thought was going to happen out of a Taste of Heritage, which, of course, never happened. And finally, my father, at about the same time, was murdered in a hospital in Los Angeles. He happened to be in the wrong place in the hood at the wrong time, and there was a doctor who was practicing on the people in the neighborhood. And my father happened to be one of them. And we sued the city. I left my job. And after appearing on 60 Minutes and just losing every emotion I had and faith in how Black people were going to be treated, I thought, well, they're certainly not going to care about food. And so I left the industry, and I've been in an exile for about 5 years, self-imposed. And then a group out of San Diego came along and again rescued me. It was called the African American Women on Tour. And this is an organization that I felt a little closer to. They had a little more control. They are an empowering organization, and they give workshops and presentations to try and empower Black women. And they have big corporate sponsors, and I thought that would be the place for me. And so what I do for them is something that I like to do to you. I want you to think a little bit about, as I've described, a childhood memory that is the most vivid memory you have about the kitchen or the food. And then think about whether there is a matriarch involved in that memory about food. I can tell you that mine is of my grandmother's cornbread. And when I got married, especially after having been a nutrition writer and I didn't really even have cream in my refrigerator, wanted to duplicate this cornbread dressing. And I my mother neglected to tell me, as they often do when they deliver a recipe, they always leave one little thing out. And I think they do that on purpose, so you'll come back and always need them to make the food for you. And so she didn't tell me that, you know, you had to handle it lightly. And so at dinner time, I had this really pretty cornbread brick. that I couldn't serve to anybody. So I've shared one, and I'm asking someone in the room to share one of their memories. Yes.
Can you hear me?
Oh, sorry.
Oh, microphone? Oh. I didn't want to share it quite that much.
Yeah, right.
Anyhow, my mother died on the 20th of May. And she died very suddenly. And she was 87, and we were closer than, you know, pathological. But the first thing that I got when I went to her house was a skillet, mm-hmm. which had been her wedding present from my father's mother. Which was all that my father's mother had to give her. And I just want to share that.
That's great. Yeah, Donna?
Mine involves my dad, although most of my memories involve my mother. But when I was in the fifth grade, my sister and I had integrated the public schools in Columbia, Missouri. And all of my friends' parents were mothers were home. And I had the only working mother. She was a teacher. And so for birthday parties, people would they would compete for the best cupcakes. The mothers, that was their, you know, they would come with these fabulous things. For my birthday, my mother said, you know, I'm at school, I'm at work. Here's money, go across the street to the Safeway and get candy bars. And I had just, as kids can be, I'd just been indignant and so upset and I cried. And she said, Donna, deal with it, I have that kind of mother. And so I went across the street at lunchtime to get candy bars, and at 2:30 that afternoon, my dad's at the door with a big box of cupcakes that he had stopped at the bakery to get.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Anybody else willing to share? Good.
My name is Jenny Ashlock, and I was, actually, this is a timely question, because last night after our last session, I just sat down, I started writing down all the memories that I had of food. Just kind of elicited that. And I guess mine would be my mother. Not so much, I mean, she was a wonderful cook, but there's just the way she organized us around mealtime. She's from Missouri, and she was a dietitian of the old food pyramid. Not to qualify that anymore. And she always had a chart, a weekly chart up on the refrigerator that told you every single day what you were going to have. Mm. So you could say Monday spaghetti, Tuesday liver. Oh, I'm eating at Susie's house that night. And it was like clockwork. And then all of our chores revolved around the kitchen, too. On the bottom of the caper chart was who was going to set the table that week, who was going to do the dishes, who was going to feed the cats. And so you knew what your life was going to be every single week around that caper chart. And it all centered around the kitchen and the food that we prepared.
It always did.
And thank you. I just realized that. Yeah. So it's a very important part of
our
life.
It's a very important part. Is there anybody else? How about that hillbilly in the back? Where is she? Will you tell us about sneaking a taste out of the still?
We didn't have a still. I'm sorry to disappoint everybody. But my father actually did work in a distillery in Louisville. We were part, as many of you know, we were part of the hillbilly diaspora who came up north in order to live. And my father took every extra shift that he could, because as you all know, if you were here yesterday, we were poor. You know, I feel like I'm on
that's okay.
One of those confession shows. You know,
it's by design.
I know. So he often worked, he worked the midnight shift, he worked time and a half overtime, and we ate at very odd times. We ate foods at odd times. And the most vivid memory, and it's odd to me that I actually have a memory that I can say is the most vivid, because I have very strong memories of food and family, as most of you know. But the absolute most vivid memory that I have is of sitting in a very small kitchen of the house that I grew up in, at about 10 o'clock at night, while my mother made chipped beef and gravy for my father and me. I got to stay up late, even though I went to school. It probably has something to do with my speckled college career, I'm sure. But I got to stay up late so I could be with my father, and we had breakfast together, and Daddy sat on one side of the table, and I sat set on the other one. It was very smoky and steamy in this kitchen, partly because we didn't heat the whole house. This is a winter memory, so the kitchen would be very hot and the door would be shut, and there would be a dampness on the windows and the door. There was a dampness in the room. My mother, God love her, was always damp because she worked all the time cooking, and there was no air conditioning in our house. And we talked, and my mother observed, and she made the chipped beef and gravy. I love my mother's chipped beef and gravy, which was very hard for people to understand when I went to college and I discovered what they ate and thought was chipped beef and gravy. And I tried to figure out how my mother did this, and of course I called her, and you're right, they leave information out. In my mother's case, it's always technique. She can tell you ingredients, but she never knows. And amounts. We talked about how much is enough. But what I do remember is a sound, and that was the sound of a metal spoon going back and forth across the mm-hmm. skillet, which provided the rhythm counterpoint to the music of my father's voice. And lo and behold, when I finally hit upon the chipped beef and gravy that my mother made, it wasn't just that she used bacon grease, and it wasn't just that she did flour, but it finally dawned on me, you have to stand there for an eternity and stir this and stir this and stir this. In other words, it's the hillbilly version of make a roux.
Wow.
It's an incredible, beautiful.
It's amazing.
Thank you.
That's one of the things that I share with the women when I speak to them. And we talked about this a little bit yesterday, and that it's not only that the younger people don't want to cook this food, our food. It's that they don't know how, and they've lost touch because this generation didn't participate, and they don't know when to turn. There's John. He's so surprised. they don't know when to turn the fried chicken over. They can't hear when it stops percolating, that it's time to turn it over. And they can't smell that the pound cake is burnt when you can smell it, that you take it out before you smell it. And so that is a really important aspect of documenting the cooking of someone that you really appreciate is knowing more than just the mechanics. The part that I always hated so much is, you know, the hows and whys and first you make a roux part. Anybody else? Uh-huh. Behind Monique.
I have two brief ones. One is about my mother. She worked when we were young, and so she decided to use the kitchen as an alternative play area for my brother and I so that she could watch us while she prepared the dinner for the family, and then that ended up meaning that my brother and I had to prepare the dinner for the family as we aged. when I was really young, she got me to be convinced that the first cakes that I made that were totally lopsided and the frosting was falling off the side were the most beautiful things that I could have made, and that they were going to be a wonderful addition to our dinner, that have helped me through this to this day, and I've used cooking as my career. But one of the things that's even almost more deep of a memory is that my grandmother would come from New York periodically, not that often. She would make rounds to each of her children's houses. But I knew that when she came, I could take the chair that had been like a stool that I had sat on as a baby and put it, or a kid, little kid, and put it in front of the stove because she would come and make me Johnny cakes. And then I would sit with her, and all day we would get ready and we'd make Johnny cakes together. And that would be like my treat when Grandma would come.
And we don't do that. It's interesting that Donna mentioned that her mother was the only working mother. Well, in the deep African-American community, the black women always worked. So we haven't been able to figure out why our community's in so much turmoil right now. Young women are debating this because, well, the black women always worked. But then when we moved and assimilated, they happened to be the only people that were working. And that was confusing, I think. They were very frustrated in the fact that they weren't the stay-at-home mommies in this neighborhood that we were moving into. And I think that created a different dynamic. And it certainly contributed to the fact that nobody was able to apprentice their children. I've read so many accounts of in our efforts to try to give black people credit, the slaves in particular, credit for being good cooks, they've alluded to this natural genius. And I would argue that that was really just, as we've just heard, it was more of an apprenticeship that gave them that they were doing it from a very early age, but they didn't come over on the boat with, you know, this automatic cooking skill. Well, I think John T's presence means that we are at the end of this part of our little discussion. And so now that you are all moved and teary-eyed, I hope, I want you to go to part B, which is to imagine that these important contributions now that we've all heard about that are distinctly different by race, by socioeconomic level, for whatever the backlash, we don't need to get in, we heard some of the backlash yesterday, but for whatever the reason, now this cultural dynamic, whether Southern food or soul food, is being killed. It's just not going to be perpetuated anymore. You can look at whether it's nationalism, racism, poor quality in the restaurants, self-loathing, whatever. It's just going to go away. And imagine the pain that you would feel of never being able to convey that to anybody. And I think that's sort of what happened and ultimately what our objective is with Southern Foodways Alliance is to be able to perpetuate these stories in such a way that they are moving and inviting to our children and to generations beyond us. And there was a question raised from the back the first day when the panel was speaking. Well, what are we going to do about this? What do we do? And we heard some very interesting answers, but none of them really were practical. And I would like to present the idea that we do more of what we just did, and that is to embrace only one memory, no longer try and be all things to all people. We don't have to any longer try to duplicate everything that Mother did in order to feel like we are competent cooks. We need to bridge the gap between our children who feel like they can open a bag of Dole to make a salad and they don't need any help in doing it, and a bridge between them and the grandmother who would not eat Glory Foods collard greens because she wouldn't know who cleaned them and how they did it. And if we just take away one memory and preserve it for our children and perhaps make hoe cakes for them on the weekends, we can perpetuate this and we can lighten up and also accept each other's differences and just embrace each other. And that's, I think, what Southern Foodways is all about. Thanks.
Daphne Durbin from the American Center for Wine, Food, and the Arts is going to talk a bit about some of the things we did last year in documenting Southern Foodways and documenting memories and recollections. And Daphne is a curator of the American Center for Wine, Food, and the Arts in Napa, California. I'll cut the lights, Daphne, just so people can see. We're only going to do this for a little bit shorter time than we expected to try to catch up, but we want y'all to see this.
Is it going to be in anybody's way? It's always a very interesting thing for me to talk about memory and oral histories because as an archaeologist, usually what I have to deal with is the tangible, the remains that people leave behind, the garbage, if you will, the things that people threw away, the small things that were forgotten. And so it is always very riveting for me to do these interviews because I find it a way to connect, and it's a way to make a connection through time and through culture and across all boundaries. And one of the things we are doing at the American Center for Wine, Food, and the Arts is trying to define what's American about wine, food, and art, what makes it American. And my strong belief is that what makes American cuisine, is that it is an individual story, that every one of us has our own story, and every one of us has our own background and our own compilation of both experience, memory, and skills and abilities, access to ingredients, regional influence. And out of that individual melting pot comes each story. And so this is a never-ending project, really, that we started here last year. And the idea is that a full, uncut version of every interview I did is here in the center and also at the American Center. What you are going to see today is an edit. It is, if you will, a taste. And at the center when we open, which is now a year away, and if any of you want to go on our website, you can see the camera on the building. You can see it taking shape. If you want to come visit me, I'll be glad to give you a hard hat tour. But we will have in our long-term exhibit a booth where every visitor can go in, and they will be prompted to go through a food memory. They will have the option to erase it if they wish, but if they leave it, we will keep it. It will be in our archives. And one of the things I did while I was here was discuss with Charles Wilson how we could really implement this documentary program and do keep pushing on the interviews, because my concern is that the living treasures and the people who make up all these millions of stories, we every day that goes by, we lose some of that memory. And so I don't want us to be left with only the tangibles. I want us to have as much of that memory as possible. So you are going to see a brief edit. There is a copy of this edit here at this center, as there will be at our center. Again, in our attempt to make sure this is as accessible as possible, there's also a still photograph of each person that was taken. So if for some reason you were only to hear the audio, you would still get an image of the person. So thank you very much for the opportunity to show you this. And I think you'll find it very interesting.
That's what I would like to do, even though I didn't know that I was doing well. I learned. When I said I was going to work in a restaurant, oh my God, what is this? This good Creole de Calais going to work in a restaurant in a French Quarter? Oh my God, she's gone crazy. You know, I should have been in a sewing factory. No Creoles went to restaurants. You could hardly get them to go there. The most you could give them at a restaurant was a sandwich, because they cooked at home. You really want to eat, you go home. They eat long. They do eat long. You know, they like long dinners. We don't like to be rushed when it's dinner time. And we could sit there for hours. My mother was too funny. You know, she said, oh, well, I need a little more wine to finish this dinner. And then the dinner would go, well, I need a little bit more dinner because I have to finish this wine. And that could go on there for the longest. So you sat to the table for hours there with her eating and you eating.
My name is John T. Edge, and I grew up in a little town called Clinton, Georgia. It's in the middle part of Georgia, near Macon, if you're looking for any kind of larger town to market by. My father would kind of make shopping expeditions to Atlanta, which was, Macon was probably 15 miles, Atlanta was an hour and a half, but my father would go up on a Sunday afternoon just to go to the grocery stores, and he'd come home with Chinese ingredients. My father would come home with anything that seemed kind of interesting to him that he wanted to play with. But he'd pull out a grill to cook it on. So I guess there's a little bit of what men are expected to do, which is cook on the grill. I would race up the little narrow road between my house and probably a half mile up the road was Old Clinton Barbecue. And Old Clinton Barbecue, you know, there's a quote from Tip O'Neill, a former Speaker of the House, who said, all politics is local. And to me, all barbecue is local. Whatever you grew up eating, that is barbecue. The place matters to me because of the characters that people it and because of the food. I still love that barbecue place. It's very much a part of my childhood. And every time I come back home, I now live in Mississippi, and every time I come back to Georgia, that's the place that feels as much like home as my place of residence did, because my parents have sold a house that I grew up in, but Old Clinton Barbecue is still there. There's still sawdust on the floor. The barbecue still tastes pretty darn good to me, and that feels like home. Feels like home. Growing up where I did in the South, wine was not a typical part of most Southerners' meals, and yet both my parents drank wine. I remember being 6 or 8 and my parents celebrating New Year's Eve. I remember on New Year's Eve them trying to convince me to drink some champagne, and I just didn't want it. And I'm sure they, at this point, I mean, they were buying a nice bottle of champagne as nice as they could find in middle Georgia in that time. And I remember them trying to coax me into drinking the champagne. I refused. I didn't want the champagne. And finally, they convinced me that if I drank the champagne, I could chase it with Mountain Dew. And once they did that, everything was fine. So I took the sip of champagne on New Year's Eve and chased it with a big glug of Mountain Dew. Somehow it entered into their consciousness that if I was introduced to wine at an early age, I wouldn't end up having a problem with wine and alcohol later. But my father loved making wine, and it would sit. We had an old cellar. It was a dirt-floored cellar, and it functioned really well as a place for wine storage. There was one bottle that my father was to put away and did put away for my 18th birthday, and we opened it with great ceremony, and it was horrible. It was truly horrible. I mean, it had gone bad, you know, probably a year after it went in the bottle, if that much. But the idea was, you know, this wine would be saved for my birthday.
My great-grandparents on either side were Cherokee, so there's a whole kind of mix that is ultimately the mix of most African-Americans, you know. There's all sorts of stuff in the pot. And basically, since what I look at is what comes out on the plate, what goes in the pot comes out on the plate. And I think what shows up on the plate is just this amazing kind of variety of food. I think the food of the African diaspora is very much about taste. We cook with our mouths. It's a wonderful expression that I heard somebody use once in St. Croix. But it's the knowledge that if you used one type of salt today and you're at a different person's house and you've changed the brand of salt, it can be saltier, it can be less salty. You taste with your mouth. So that that, coupled with the oral tradition, which means that our recipes don't get necessarily passed down in family cookbooks or in little note cards that have been meticulously written. First of all, many of my ancestors probably couldn't write. But along with not being able to write, it doesn't follow logically that because they didn't write, they didn't store things or they didn't pass things on. Because what they did do was talk about them. And talk about them in certain kinds of ways so that there's this orality of the culture of African Americans that really allows for a vibrant life. And that shows up in the plate and it shows up in the recipes.
I was born in Chester County, which is about 30 miles west of Philadelphia. When I was little, there was a swinging door between the kitchen and the dining room. And it was made very clear to me that the males were to stay on the dining room side of the door. And we observed all the niceties of, really, of English country life. And that included Christmas Eve dinner. Begin with champagne. Even the children were allowed to have a little bit of champagne. And we had finger bowls with a little slice of a little leaf of lemon verbena floating in it. And we were very proud of ourselves as children that we knew how to use a finger bowl. You know, you became slightly adult when you graduated from splashing around in your finger bowl to actually using it like a proper diner. As far as I know, there weren't any real wine lovers in my family until I came along. I was taken to a French restaurant in Houston and given a white wine, I think from Bordeaux, but it was just extraordinary that I knew that from that moment of having a glass or two of that wine, that there was something here I really needed to look into. A good cook in any culture can make delicious food.
I'm Kathy Starr. I'm from Hollandale, Mississippi. I grew up in Hollandale, Mississippi with my grandmother. I was the only child at home, and of course my grandmother, who taught me how to cook, taught me all the things that I needed to know about her family and how they shared in meal service and how they shared foods. She began telling me those things at the age of 5. And I stayed in somewhat of an apprenticeship until I was about the age of 26 years old. We learned how to eat off of the land, how to eat healthy, how to eat good vegetables and good meats and prepare them well. Everything that we cook is prepared from scratch. That's how I was taught. We don't use any measuring cups. Everything we do is by what we've learned, basic knowledge, and how to actually dip up a teaspoon of salt without actually using a measuring spoon. And that's how my grandmother taught me. In the home, food was extremely important. It was the center of family gatherings for us. My grandmother and I used that as a time to really share with each other.
My name is Fritz Blank, and I come from New Jersey. I happen to be a chef for the past 20 years. My ethnic background is Germanic. My grandmother essentially raised me, and she taught me how to cook at a very early, early age. I was 3, I can remember being with her and she allowing me to cook. That never left me. It's interesting that my restaurant is French and my background is German, and that may seem to be a little offbeat, but the principles of using all the senses to cook, in that my grandmother showed me how to cook. Holidays were always a fussed over affair, and inevitably it was celebrated at the table. All of the foods, all of the German foods, the German potato salad, the things that were us. I knew that there was no room in Philadelphia for a German restaurant. French, on the other hand, was something that had interested me because of the careful attention to details that went into classic French. And my first cookbook was a Time Life cookbook, and I cooked at home from the first page through the end. It was in a little town called Juan-les-Pins on the Côte d'Azur, and he had a garden. And he went every day and got the bread and stuck it under his arm. In the morning, we had breakfast out on this little porch veranda type thing, and with sausages from Corsica and bread and butter and cheeses and coffee that he brewed in a great cauldron. And the camaraderie and the conviviality in that setting was perfect. There have been greater meals that I have enjoyed with 12, 13 courses, but none stick into my memory like that, those simple breakfasts we had.
I'm Frances Howard. That was from Oxford, Mississippi.
I'm Michael Howard. I'm 12, and I live in Oxford.
Well, actually, we go to my grandmom's house, and we have turkey, of course, with cranberry dressing and mashed sweet potatoes with marshmallows on top. That's my favorite part. And a lot of stuff. We have a huge meal, and we always have pecan pie at the end.
Or fudge
pie. That's pretty good, too. Caramel. I like caramel cake.
I start out with an egg roll. Some egg rolls. Then for the main course, spaghetti or lasagna. I like that. It's good. And for dessert, carrot cake.
I forgot to put the oatmeal in oatmeal cookies once.
I'm Ty Gillespie, and I was born in Jackson, and I'm 11 years old, and I live here. I like fruits and vegetables mainly.
I don't eat salad.
Brussels sprouts.
I'm Lois Eric Eli, and I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana. My first dish was a classic. It was instant grits with margarine. And I perfected it and then began to move on to other things. Barbecue as metaphor. The idea that you could look at barbecue, if you look at the definitive qualities of American culture, you could look at them in the context of barbecue and see that they're all amplified in barbecue. Barbecue expresses all the range of people that have come to the United States. There's obviously the African connection in terms of the fact that although I could not point to an actual invention of barbecue by African Americans, so the quintessential barbecue experience has always been to go on the other side of the track into the black neighborhoods and get that food. So we got that connection. Obviously, we then end up with the Mexican-American tradition with the barbacoa and one potential explanation for how the word barbecue came to be. Well, if you look at any modern barbecue cookbook, you'll also see recipes including soy sauce and teriyaki or recipes for Jamaican jerk seasoning. All those things express the kind of range of peoples in barbecue, not to mention the idea of barbecue being a food that brings together people of different social classes.
My name is John Martin Taylor, and I think of myself as a culinary preservationist. By the time we moved to Orangeburg, South Carolina, when I was 3 years old, my father was a founding member of Les Amis du Vin, and we had a wine cellar, which is pretty amazing to imagine this little tiny town in the low country of South Carolina having a wine cellar in the 50s. This was unheard of. And my mother was a very adventurous cook. When she died 30 years later, she left me about 1,200 cookbooks, which became part of my career. But though she was a traditional Southern cook, we traveled a lot, too, and we lived on boats a lot. And a lot of what I think of as how I cook comes out of a galley kitchen. This one-pot cooking actually made sense on a boat growing up. If mother would say, oh, tonight we go to Czechoslovakia, for example, which she would do because she had these books and she would love to take us off and expand her horizons. When Julia Child started being on television in the early 60s, mom was right there with her. But even when we would go out to Czechoslovakia, everything had to be based on what we could get. Mother would literally give me a bucket and say, go get lunch. You use rice or grits the way Italians say would use pasta. A lot of these traditional Southern dishes are only as traditional as you know them. You cross the street and barbecue sauces change hue and tone, literally across the street. Italy's smallest region, the Italian Riviera and the mountains right up into the Piedmont, there are regions there where the cooking is all but identical to my paternal grandmother's cooking from Appalachia. Wood-burning stove, cast iron pots, cornmeal, mush, polenta, same thing, exactly the same thing. If you have a plant where everything is totally eaten up by bugs and worms, if you have this one tomato that's perfect, it's worth it. That's what summer's about, is that tomato. And that's what the South's about to me, is that tomato, the Perlo. One dish, main course, rice, tomatoes, shrimp, maybe a little bacon, onions, celery, fresh herbs. That's it. The salad might be it might be African influenced. It might have some benny seeds, which is a West African word for sesame, and that are very strong in the cooking of where I grew up. So there's a green salad, cornbread, Perlo. That's dinner. Typical and common and often. Feeds a lot of people. Here we go. This is my meal. You open your oysters. You have a glass of champagne. You switch to red wine. You have your shrimp Perlo. And for dessert, muscadine sorbet. My father had an amazing wine cellar. When I was born in 1949, he bought a lot of the 49 Burgundies, which was one of the four great years of all times. And he had saved one bottle of a Chambord Musigny from the 49. vintage, he said, let's drink this. It was the last bottle he had left, and my mother had died unexpectedly and young. And we had this bottle of wine. We had a piece of beef, and I'm sure we had local vegetables that were fresh. I know that's what we had because that's all we ever eat. But I remember this piece of beef, but mostly I remember this bottle of wine and just being with my father the last day in his house with this last bottle of wine and toasting my mother and our love of food. And it was really a great meal.